Welcome to the program for October 26th, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Happy to have in studio for Pentagon Solutions today two of the co-authors of a report released by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The title of the report is U.S. Department of Defense Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base. And I'm pleased to have in studio Guy Benari and Greg Sanders of CSIS. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being here today. I appreciate having you with me.
Great to be here. Thanks, Francis.
The report has been out for a little while now, and you've started to get some response to it. First, tell me what the purpose of this is. You've been doing this for any number of years, Guy.
Right.
Tell me why you do this every year, and then tell me what the response has been so far, please.
So what we really do here, and as you said, Francis, we're doing this for a good 5, 6, 7 years now, is tracking the trends in contract spending by various government agencies. In this case, we'll talk about DOD, the Department of Defense, the largest government agency in terms of spending by far. And we do this to see sort of what the major trends are in terms of both how much money is being spent, what it's being spent on, who's doing the spending within DOD in terms of which of the military services, which of the civilian agencies, and also what the money is spent on, product, services, research and development, et cetera, et cetera. And that gives you not just sort of a historic look at what's been happening, but might be an indication of where we are going in the future.
Greg, the mantra that we hear all the time is that DOD spends more money on services now than they do on products. Did that bear out in the research that you did? To what level did it, and what are you seeing in that area?
Yes, it did bear out, although that trend is actually a bit older than people often realize. There was actually a jump in services. The way DOD categorizes it includes research and development spending. So if you take those definitions, we break it out separately. Services have often been higher as a percentage, and we've actually seen a bit of a product comeback driven by the war, unsurprisingly. Products as a percentage actually peaked in the 07-08 period and have now been dropping off. Though ever since 1992, we've actually been below 50%. But again, that includes R&D as a service. So some people may categorize that differently.
Should it be categorized differently? Should we have product services and R&D as a kind of a separate line item, Guy, do you think?
So I think we should, and it helps with the analysis because it really is a different market and different market dynamics for each of these categories. So it's the way that the contracting data is categorized in the first place, and we maybe we'll take a step back here for a second, Francis, and say we use public data here. We use the Federal Procurement Data System, which captures only prime contracts and only unclassified contracts, but still it's, in DOD's case, a significant share of the money that's spent. And so it's publicly available data about, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, about 3 million contract actions a year now.
Transactions. Yeah.
Transactions, yes. So anything worth more than $2,500 is captured in this database. And so the breakdown into product, services, R&D is valuable. It helps you get granularity because they are such different markets for each of these categories.
Is it your sense that the contractors treat R&D separately than DOD does, or do they do it the same way because that's how the agency does it?
No, I think they do treat it differently, and it is its own sort of its own domain, its own industrial base. Interestingly enough, when you look at sort of who the top contractors are in this marketplace, it is a very different group, if you will, from the overall top DOD contractors. And for sure, you have the large companies in there, the Lockheed Martins, the Boeings, the Northrop Grummans, et cetera, et cetera. But you'll also see universities in there, MIT, for example, very prominent in defense research and development. You'll see some of what we call FFRDCs, federally funded research and development centers, like the MITRE Corporation, like the Aerospace Corporation. You'll see some joint ventures between industry and academia. where they come together for specific research and development efforts. So it's a very interesting mix, a very distinct marketplace as opposed to the products and services market.
Now, one of the charts that you have in this report, and we have it linked up, and we have the slide presentation linked up.
Fantastic.
At federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. One of the charts that you have in this is a comparison of the top 20 contractors 2001 versus 2011. A lot of the names are the same. Folks who have followed this market will recognize some of the names that are different,
right,
as still being represented on the
yes.
list in one form or another.
Yes, indeed.
But talk about what the differences that you see and what they mean in your view, either one, whichever would like
Greg,
to take it.
Yeah, there's a few interesting things on the chart. First off, to make the chart at all in 2001 in constant dollars, you needed a little under $700 million. To make the chart at all, you now need to be making $2.6 billion in DOD obligations. And that's with the percentage of funds going to the top 20 staying relatively constant. So what we're seeing is the big companies or the big providers are keeping a relatively similar share. Though if we look at the top five, that share has actually dropped off a bit. So it was a little under 30%, so 29% in 2001 going to the big five and down to 26.5. So the mid-year is the wrong term here, but the sixth through fifth 20 companies have been gaining a slightly larger share of things. We're also seeing a bit more in terms of healthcare. HealthNet was around in 2001, but we're seeing Humana, we're seeing TriWest move up the list. And some of that, I think, is driven logically enough by people coming out of the wars needing more services.
That was the element, I think, of this top 20 list that jumped out at me, guys. In 2001, two of the top 20 were healthcare providers, and they were ranked at number 13 and number 19. In 2011, that list included three companies on the list, and they were ranked right at 13, 14, 15, right in a cluster there.
Absolutely. That's an important point.
And the total number of dollars is dramatically higher, almost five times as much.
Yeah. Yes, it was $2 billion for those two companies you mentioned in 2001, and it's close to $10 billion for the three companies in 2011. And there's two interesting points to be made here. One is this represents the sharp increase in, as Greg mentioned, overall healthcare and medical related services in the last decade, primarily. This, in of all the service categories, this has been the fastest growing one for by value for DOD. It's grown at, I think, something like 15% a year for the last 10, 11 years, which is incredible. But the second point is that market is mainly captured by those three companies. So there's not a lot of industrial base, if you will, here. There's really just the three big players that capture the majority of the market share.
The comment that I think of when I looked at that list was Secretary Gates's comment about healthcare costs. I think the quote he used was eating us alive
right.
At that time. And certainly nothing has changed. But in context of the numbers overall, as I mentioned, those three companies are clustered together at 13, 14, and 15. But when you add them all together, they still wouldn't make the top five based on the numbers that we see here.
Sure.
So there's still an awful lot of money, although healthcare costs are increasing for the Pentagon, there's still an awful lot of money going other places.
Absolutely.
Top five on your list, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman. No surprises there, really. And the only member of the top five 10 years ago that's not in there now is Newport News Shipbuilding.
Which, of course, was bought by Northrop Grumman.
Exactly.
And
so that accounts for Northrop Grumman perhaps making it into the list this time around.
Right.
And for Newport News not being there this time.
Although, sorry, Francis, an interesting point there is that in 2011, Northrop spun off Huntington Ingalls, their shipbuilding business, and that's now the number nine, I believe, eight or nine contractor on the 2011 top 20 list. And so this is an interesting perspective overall on this this list. We mentioned that the market share of the top 20 has remained relatively steady over time at about 40-43%, but the companies on the list have changed. And that's a reflection of the different types of contract dollars going to different players. When you're conducting multiple operations overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan, primarily ground operations, you see that the number of companies producing and selling ground systems, land systems, take an increasingly larger share of the market in recent years. And so it's a very dynamic market. There's a lot of fluctuation, and we expect that to continue as we draw down, spend less on land systems. There's now talk of sort of the air sea battle concept and investing more in the Navy and the Air Force. We predict that that'll be reflected in the top 20 list in the coming years.
Well, let's talk some more about that when we come back. The mergers and acquisitions issue has been front and center in this space, especially over the past 2 years or so, I would say.
Absolutely.
But Secretary Lynn, when he was still Deputy Secretary, and now Deputy Secretary Carter, in both his position as ATL and now as Deputy Secretary, have talked about this landscape of the defense industrial base. And maybe we can talk when we come back about how that shifted and what that might mean. My guests on Federal News Radio 1500 today include Guy Ben-Ari and Greg Sanders of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And you can find out more about this research they've done, U.S. Department of Defense contract spending and the supporting industrial base. When we that's all on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and our conversation continues in just a moment.
Community policing. How does it contribute to the safety of neighborhoods? What is the mission of the DOJ's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services? How has the era of fiscal austerity changed the way law enforcement operate? And how can technology enhance community policing? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Bernard Melikan, director of the COPS office, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Hey, not coming to the playoff game?
Yeah, Sammy's game is Sunday.
Cool, but you're going to miss an awesome game.
Nah, we just got a new GMC Acadia that comes standard with HD radio technology. The game's actually on one of the local HD2 channels now.
Nice ride.
Yeah, I went to HDradio.com, checked out all kinds of brands. Hyundai, Kia, Chevrolet, Mercedes, Toyota, BMW, Audi. You should see Artist Experience. It's amazing.
I'm going to have to check that out. HD Radio, now available from 28 different automobile brands and more than 150 vehicles. Go to HDradio.com for more.
We have a big
reward
just for federal employees, a wellness incentive worth up to $50. And that's just one of the extra benefits at no extra cost with the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Service Benefit Plan. You also get everything from free annual physicals to generic drug incentives. To learn about our other
rewards
and about the wellness incentive, visit extras.fepblue.org or call 1-800-411-BLUE.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because the Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
The year was 1957. The date was October 4th, and Americans woke up to a strange new reality. The first satellite launched into space wasn't ours. The Russians had gotten there first. Sputnik 1 may have been the size of a beach ball, but it was the space shot heard round the world.
Today, a new moon is in the sky.
And it galvanized the nation into action. The Martin Company rose to meet the challenge. Then, on St. Patrick's Day, 1958, a Martin-built Vanguard rocket roared into space with a Shamrock taped to its side and put the world's first solar-powered satellite into orbit. 4 months later, the president signed the legislation that created NASA. The rest, as they say, is history. A history that is still being written by the scientists and engineers of Lockheed Martin. Their story is our story. See it unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Thursday's Federal Drive. USAID turns to the nation's college campuses to launch a challenge. It's looking for new ideas to combat human trafficking and an end to modern slavery. Plus, we'll hear from the guy who figured out how to make military satellite communications more secure. His team at MilSatCom won an award. Those stories and more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Trends in defense contract spending, what we're looking at today on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Guy Benari and Greg Sanders. And gentlemen, your work is linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We were speaking a minute ago about the landscape of the defense industrial base right now. And I mentioned during our time during the commercial break that when Bill Lynn was still the Deputy Secretary of Defense and now Ashton Carter in that role and his previous role as the acquisitions technology and logistics, both of them have talked pretty extensively and in detail about the desire of the Department of Defense to participate in shaping the defense industrial base, having a role in what that landscape looks like. What do you see in regards to that in the numbers that you've looked at here? Do you get a sense of how DOD is doing that by its spending, or is there a chicken and egg thing here that one has to come before the other can come? Guy, I'll start with you on that one.
Yes. So first, as we mentioned earlier, it's funny because while as a federal government, we don't have an industrial policy and we refuse to even talk about sort of government intervention in the marketplace and in a broader level. We have a deputy assistant secretary now for industrial policy within the Department of Defense, and that's traditionally been an area where there's always been very significant government intervention and government involvement, and we expect that to continue. To your question about how it's reflected in our data, you can see that first of all, as the biggest customer for a lot of these defense companies, DOD, and the places where it spends its money and how it spends its money and the contract vehicles that it uses and the funding mechanisms that it uses, all of these shape the market in very significant and very direct ways. It has in the past forced things like mergers and acquisitions. We remember the Last Supper in the early 90s where Secretary of Defense said, "We want consolidation in the defense industrial base," and he got it. We're seeing a lot of it now in different ways, with companies responding to DOD contract spending, in ways like, mergers and acquisitions, in ways like, spinning off different parts of their company and divesting themselves of different parts. We mentioned, Northrop and, Huntington, sort of, that divestiture. We recently saw, more of these in the services sector, actually, with L3 and, as you mentioned, SAIC, divesting their service business into different companies. And so we expect to see more of that in the future. The interesting thing is about the coming years will be how companies respond. And I know Greg has some thoughts on this, but my own are that there's no clear strategy here that the industrial base as a whole seems to have embraced. It used to be that in past drawdowns, and we are entering a drawdown, we'll probably get to talking about that in a minute, but in past drawdowns, there was always sort of the big industrial strategy that worked for everybody, whether it was more mergers and acquisitions, whether it was diversifying into commercial versus defense only. Now we're not really seeing any one strategy emerging, and we're seeing certain companies, you know, going down the divestiture route. We're seeing certain companies doing more mergers and acquisitions. We're seeing certain companies diversify. We're seeing more companies specialize. And so it really is going to be an interesting next few years to see which of these strategies turns out to be the right one.
Greg, as you look at this landscape and in the context especially of what Guy was talking about, do we get any clues from the data as to what that will look like, or because of other issues that we haven't gotten into yet, like sequestration, budget pressures overall, and so forth. Is it just too hard to get an indication of where we may be headed? I guess it's we should start calling it M&A and D instead of just M&A.
I think we have some broad outlines. Throughout our entire past years, there's fluctuations and trends often move in directions that you might not expect. For example, while everything else was going down, Navy products has had a banner year in 2011, at least on the contract side. But we can also look at some of the charts in our report for signs of how effectively the industrial base is being managed to some extent. We like looking at our competition chart, which has a competition with single offer category. Most of this management is an attempt to either make sure that we have a secure source from U.S. for things, and once that's secured, or once we're comfortable with something else, making sure that we have potential for multiple offers so that we can compete, get margins out, et cetera. And so we like looking at the competition with a single offer, which is sometimes referred to as fake competition by defense officials, as sort of a way of monitoring how this is going. In recent years, throughout the war years, that category shot up along with all other kinds of spending. We're seeing it drop back a bit, but we're seeing it drop back a bit in proportion. This isn't necessarily a good news story. And to the degree that it grows as a proportion means that we're having some, the defense officials are having some trouble getting out of the sector what they want. On the other hand, if you're a contractor and you're competing with the only person making an offer, you're probably pretty happy where you are.
Mm-hmm. As we look at that space and try to connect all of this, one of the things, the other things we talked about during the last commercial break was just the overall uncertainty that we see. And Guy, you've alluded to sequestration already. It really is the 800-pound gorilla in any conversation room in Washington right now, whether it's DOD or anything else. What's that mean as far as an overlay on the kind of work that you've done this year compared to the past? And what does that do as far as trying to extrapolate or project from this data to what we might see in 2013 and beyond?
Right. So overall, on the demand side, so the DOD spending side of things, our data goes back, from, 1990 all the way through fiscal year 2011. Most of those years have been growth years where the overall spending each year has been greater than the previous year. That sort of peaked in 2008-2009, and since then it's been on a downward trend. We're still talking significant numbers. I mean, in 2011, overall contract spending by DOD was around $375 billion for that year alone. And as a share of overall DOD spending, that was at around 55%, just to give you a sense of where we were. Where we're going is probably a continuation of that downward trend, both in terms of overall spending and in terms of the contract's share of total defense spending, because of things like sequestration, because of things like the drawdown from Iraq and Afghanistan that is well underway now. And we already know that, for example, in fiscal years 12 and 13, the investment account in DOD, which covers acquisition and research and development, took the greater share of the budget cuts. And so we anticipate a continuation of this downward trend in contract obligations, not just in total dollars, but as their share of the overall defense budget.
As we look at the number we keep hearing on sequestration, if it happens, and it seems to me anecdotally that the sentiment in Washington seems to be more and more likely that it won't happen. But until it doesn't, until we know it's not going to, I guess we have to kind of plan for it to happen. But as I look at these numbers, I think the 2011 number that you have for total contract spending is $375 billion.
That's right.
if we go I'm not going to do 9.7%, but if that number goes down to 340 billion, say, the rough estimate,
right. We're talking,
there's still a whole lot of money there for people to go to. And I'm not sure, especially we're right in the middle of earnings season. My producer, Beth Reardon, showed me some of the results from some of these companies today. It doesn't look like a 9 or 10% reduction. I know it wouldn't be straight across the board for everybody,
right.
But it doesn't look like a 9 or 10% reduction in revenue is going to put anybody out of business anytime soon. What do you think that says about where some of these companies are? Say we did have sequestration, worst case scenario, and nobody's able to do anything in the lame duck session and so on. What does that mean, do you think, future-wise? Is this going to be as bad as some folks are trying to make it out to be? Did you get any indication of what that might look like from your data?
As far as the data show, it's really hard to tell. And it really will depend not just on whether sequestration will be a fact of life in January or not, but defense cuts are coming one way or another, whether through sequestration, whether as part of the Budget Control Act. They're coming, and they're coming, as you said, at the rate of probably something like $50 billion a year. Is that about right, Greg? I'm trying to do the math quickly in my head.
I know the feeling. I guess the point that I'm getting to is maybe are we focused too much on the concept of sequestration in and of itself because it's a funny word and it's imminent when, in fact, if a company's trying to plan strategy, that point that you're making, Guy, that these cuts are coming to the tune of $40 to $50 billion a year for the foreseeable future, maybe that should be where people are focused. And it doesn't seem like people are focused there right now. It seems like people are focused on January 2nd and 9.7%.
I think that's what you're hearing. But really, certainly from an industry perspective, the cuts have been sort of on the horizon for quite some time now. And I think industry has been planning for it, for them. We knew we were going to draw down from Iraq eventually. We knew that we were going to draw down from Afghanistan. The government set specific time frames for each of these drawdowns with specific, you know, indications of troop levels for each of them. So there was a sense that this is coming. There was a pretty good sense of when it was coming. And companies have had time to adjust. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. They've had time to develop their strategies on M&A, on divestitures, on diversification, specialization, et cetera. And let's not forget that they are sitting on huge amounts of cash as a result of this incredible growth in the last decade and more. So the big question for them now is where to put that money and which strategy to use when investing it.
I want to
One other thing, it's interesting to look at the history. To get down to the 2001 contract obligation level, you need to cut of around 50%. And to get down to that number you mentioned after sequestration, that takes us back to the 2006 level when we still have both wars going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I want to get into when we come back. Just for a moment before we move on to other things is what some of these numbers mean relative to each other,
yes.
Which I think is something that we've kind of lost sight of in this whole conversation. My guests from the Center for Strategic and International Studies today, Greg Sanders and Guy Ben-Ari, talking about trends in defense contract spending. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Agency of the Month, sponsored by ICF International.
Dr. Carolyn Clancy, director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, talks about prioritizing research.
We have an ongoing process of planning and environmental scanning at all times. I don't think a day goes by that we aren't sharing information with each other about, you know, what I'm hearing from patients.
Agency of the Month, Wednesdays at 11 in October on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
To have the greatest impact, you must tackle the most important problems. All over the world, ICF International applies strategy, science, and technology to help clients achieve measurable results, including healthier people and vibrant communities. This is ICF International, and their work helps government health programs, like those run by the National Institutes of Health, improve the quality of life. Find out how ICF's informatics, research, and communication work helps make a difference at ICFI.com.
This week's Experts in Health topic is lung cancer detection, featuring Dr. Allison Mirabella, a pulmonologist with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, who practices at Kaiser Permanente's Capitol Hill Medical Center.
Lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer fatalities in the United States and is primarily caused by tobacco use. Hi, I'm Dr. Mirabella. At Kaiser Permanente, we understand the importance of minimally invasive procedures, which is why we employ state-of-the-art technology such as endobronchial ultrasound, or EBUS. One of the best ways to prevent lung cancer is to quit smoking and avoid secondhand smoke. Permanente physicians provide personal and comprehensive care to our members, so it's no surprise that Kaiser Permanente Mid-Atlantic outperforms all the other local plans in quality measures according to the Maryland Healthcare Commission's 2011 Health Benefit Plan Performance Report.
Dr. Mirabella was recently recognized as a top doctor in Washingtonian Magazine. For more information, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Noroviruses get around. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Noroviruses are tiny, but they're one of America's busiest bugs. Researcher Aaron Hall of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looked at foodborne outbreaks in the United States.
Noroviruses are the leading cause of outbreaks from contaminated food in the United States. These outbreaks resulted in over 10,000 illnesses, 1,200 healthcare provider visits, 150 hospitalizations, and one death each year.
Hall says noroviruses spread very easily, especially by sick food handlers, and by eating contaminated foods like leafy vegetables, fruits, and oysters. So food handlers should wash hands carefully, not touch food barehanded, and stay out of the kitchen when they're sick. The study is in CDC's journal Emerging Infectious Diseases. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Pending legislation, federal budget cuts, contracting efficiencies, contract management best practices, acquisition trends, and the relationship of government and industry will be discussed at NCMA's upcoming 31st Annual Government Contract Management Conference, November 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. Hear from Ted Leonsis, CEO of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, Frank Kendall, Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, and General George Casey, former U.S. Army Chief of Staff. Learn more at ncmahq.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, releasing their annual analysis of contract spending. The title of the publication, Department of Defense Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base. And my guests talking about it with me on Pentagon Solutions today, Greg Sanders and Guy Benari of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We talked a little bit about the shaping of the defense industrial base and M&A in the last segment. And we just have a few minutes in this segment to get back on track. But my question is, we talked about very quickly, Greg, at the end of the last break, you mentioned kind of the comparative numbers that we're looking at here. One of the things that I think it gets sort of lost in the conversation is what the top line numbers and the contracting numbers are relative to each other. I picked out a couple, and you're certainly welcome to cite any that you think are important to add context to what this conversation looks like. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking at your chart on page 5 of this report, and it lists $375 billion as total contract spending in FY 2011 compared to total top-line DOD spending of $408 billion in fiscal 2002 and a total top-line of $539 billion in fiscal 2005 when we were right in the middle of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As I said, any numbers you would like to add that you think would give context to those numbers I think would be instructive. But what do you think those numbers say about the context of the conversation that we're having about this issue in Washington right now?
Right. So I think some of that can be attributed to things that accumulate over a war, as you need to take care of people, as you need to replace equipment, et cetera. But another part would seem to indicate that if you can take the time to be strategic about what you're doing. Sequestration is scary because sequestration would mean a flat reduction at some level. The exact level would be debated. But if you do some of what Secretary Gates did, even as it rose, and pick programs that you don't think are relevant anymore, you would seem to have, from a straight numbers perspective, the room you need. And I think the numbers you cited were completely accurate. I could cite a few more, but that is sufficient to say that we could run a war on this level, two wars on this level of spending. We're now running one and we're leaving.
Right. I think another interesting number, just since we're throwing them out here, is the number for contract obligations, defense spending on products, services, and research and development in 2011 was $375 billion. We've mentioned this several times. But that's pretty much the level of total DOD spending in 2001 and 2002. So we spend as much on contracts in 2011 as we did on
the entire
all things defense,
DOD, yeah.
Including personnel and benefits and the labs and the facilities and everything in just a decade ago. So this is really part of the overall context. Another quick comment I'd like to make here is sort of putting it even in a broader context. And going back to Greg's comment, part of what happened as a result of the last drawdown that we had post-Cold War, so the so-called peace dividend, is not only did we see fewer defense dollars being spent, we saw also sort of as part of the broader Clinton administration's push for reinventing government, right? Sort of having government do fewer things and doing them better and relying on the private sector for more things, with the assumption that they would be done more efficiently and effectively by the private sector. We as the government, and that goes for DOD as well as other parts, gave up on certain services and certain capabilities and skill sets and essentially said, we'll rely on the private sector for those. That happened in sort of the early to mid-90s. Fast forward 5-10 years, we're in two major wars, and all of a sudden, we need those services, we need those skills, we need those people that we let go and turn to the private sector for, and that accounts for the majority of the growth that we saw in the war years. A lot of it is going on people as opposed to things, because we lost inside the government the ability to perform these functions.
When we come back, I want to talk more about that issue, because I'm sure that you paid a lot of attention to the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and
Indeed.
Afghanistan. And I would be curious to see what you learned from that commission and how that applies to the research that you've done. And again, what context that can add to what we've seen so far. My guests on the program today, both from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Guy Ben-Ari and Greg Sanders, talking about CSIS's report called Department of Defense Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base. You can find out more about it right now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The report is linked there, some instructional slides about the report to help you understand the data even better, and lots more. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Attention civilian employees of the intelligence community and the Departments of Defense and State. You could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com/term life. That's GEBA.com/term life. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
For a faster, easier way for your agency to go green, choose GSA's Green Aisles, the custom online purchasing channels on GSA Advantage and GSA Global Supply. Each item in the Green Aisles is identified and labeled with environmental indicators like Energy Star, EPEAT, and more, so you can find the green products and services you need and meet all of your agency's sustainability requirements, environmental and economic. To learn more, join the conversation today at interact.gsa.gov/sustainability.
Life is long and filled with challenges. Navigating these can be difficult, but it doesn't have to be. Hi, this is Lisa Millman from AFMA. For over 133 years, AFMA has been leading military personnel through difficult times to a more secure future by offering the right products and services at the right time for the best price. Our low-cost life insurance and personal approach allow us to help you plan wisely and feel comfortable that your family will be taken care of. Our unparalleled survivor assistance services will allow your family to take a deep breath and relax knowing we'll take care of everything. When you choose AFMA, you choose a partner who will provide guidance, simple solutions, and personalized care. Our life insurance policies are available to all members of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. For a free life insurance quote, call a membership coordinator at 1-877-398-2263 or find us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
Do you hear that? That's a cuttlefish. Ars Raytheon sees it the future of infrared technology. By studying how cephalopods manipulate light, we're driving innovation in IR imaging. With systems that are lighter, use less power, and deliver revolutionary clarity. After all, when your mission is innovation, your inspiration can come from anywhere. Raytheon. Customer success is our mission. Do you hear that? That's something we make safer and more efficient every day. Raytheon helps manage two-thirds of the world's airspace, modernizing, integrating, and supporting today's air traffic systems. For decades, we've continued to innovate as the nation's airways have continued to grow. After all, when your mission is transforming air travel, the sky's the limit. Raytheon. Customer success is our mission.
By combining HP 3PAR utility storage with HP ProLiant Gen 8 servers powered by the latest Intel Xeon processors, you can lower your total cost of ownership and improve project ROI. GovConnection, a federal elite HP partner, can show you how HP can power your data center into the future. Call GovConnection's experienced federal team, where service and commitment to the customer are priority one. Call 800-800-0019 today.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Some more conversation with the Center for Strategic and International Studies talking about some of the research they've done in a paper called Department of Defense Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base. It is research that they do every year, and bringing it together in this publication that you can find out more about at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Greg Sanders and Guy Benari of CSIS are in studio with me to talk about it on Pentagon Solutions today. Greg, I mentioned before we went to the last break about the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. To my knowledge, it's the first time that such a group has been convened to focus very specifically in one area, and you can tell if you pay any attention to their name what they were charged with doing. Now, this is a group that you paid a lot of attention to while they were still working. As you think about their work and the results that they presented to Congress, and then look at the numbers that we've been looking at this afternoon, where is there an intersection? Where is there common ground, maybe? Or where is there a kind of a diffusion of those two, and how one impacts the other?
Right. Well, one interesting thing is that some of the trends with regard to, you know, use of competition, I mean, we saw a rise of single offer, but also to some extent with fixed price versus cost plus, actually maintained somewhat consistent ratios. There was a lot of attention particularly as an increasing amount of tension as to how things were spent. In the early years, just looking at the raw data, you can tell when it's iffy. When there's lots of JCCIA data, Joint Contracting Commander Act Afghanistan, where the dominant category is 99999, which, as you might guess, is just a miscellaneous category, to in the later years where you have a lot more filled in, you have a lot more attention at every level, in part because if we're spending our contract money badly in these fields, in what's called often contingency contracting, that money might either be getting to corrupt locals that are changing the balance of power, or worse yet, being paid to warlords, even the Taliban or the like. And that becomes a very real fear. Though I think at the same time, the overall ratio is being constant. War is an incredibly inefficient enterprise. And
the understatement of the program so far.
It can be very easy to lose track of some of the bigger picture in saying, well, are we getting full accounting on this when war is just incredibly expensive, incredibly resource-consuming, and you can get stuck in smaller issues when sometimes the concentration should also stay on the bigger picture. If it costs $1 million a year for someone to be there, upping competition by 5% will not really be moving the needle necessarily.
Mm-hmm. There are a tremendous amount of numbers in the work that you've done, and I commend it to anybody who wants to understand
what is
happening in this field. Yeah, obviously so, and you're very good with them, by the way. The thing that I find most valuable in research like this, though, is the ability to use it to try to extrapolate, project, predict, and so forth.
Sure.
We have a confluence of events in this particular area right now that I wonder, I'll get your input on. We have the wars drawing down. We have the sequestration and budget impact that we've already talked about pretty extensively. The changing landscape of the defense industrial base, in some cases because of the elements that I've just named, and in some cases just because of the standard nature of doing business.
Right. Market dynamics.
That's exactly right. Things that go on for any number of reasons. Is it possible, even with all of these variables, with all of the things that we don't know what will happen about, to even make predictions or to extrapolate, to try to predict for the future? Or is that a bad idea, given all of the uncertainties that we have?
No, I think it's a good idea. It's just really hard. What we try to do when we put together this data, I said we like numbers and I meant it, but we don't produce them for just to have them. We try to connect the dots and pull out interesting trends that might be evident if you have the numbers and look at them in various ways. So I think there are different things that come out of it, and we don't have time to discuss them all. I'd encourage our listeners to look at the report overall. I'll just mention maybe one, and Greg can speak to another. But for me, an interesting indicator is always, when looking ahead, is always research and development and how we spend our research and development money. And when I say we, it's both government and industry. And we look at government only in this report, but we have numbers on our website and in other reports on how industry spends its research and development dollars. And that has me worried, and especially when taken in the context of all the other broader issues that you mentioned, drawdowns and sequestration and changes in the industrial base. But we've really seen a drop in both the share of overall in total research and development dollars spent by both industry and DOD on research and development. And we've seen a decrease in the share of research and development dollars as a share of the overall defense budget and as a share of the revenue that companies earn. And so if you consider, and we do, if you consider research and development as a proxy metric for, you know, the capabilities that we'll have, the products that we'll have, the services that we'll be offering 5, 10, 15 years down the road, these indicators are worrisome. We're essentially eating our seed corn at a time when we're asking our men and women in uniform to essentially do more with less, and not just now, but in the years ahead. And so And especially, again, taken in the broader context of sequestration and just less money to go around, the fact that for the last few years we've seen a reduction in the total amounts of spending on R&D, and that is expected to continue, that's a worrisome trend for us.
And this is happening at a time, too, when people at every agency, including DOD, tell me we want to see more innovation, especially from industry. And it strikes me that that innovation is probably going to come from their R&D spending. And if that's trending the wrong direction, that doesn't bode well in that area either. Greg, what do you see as far as what we can pull out, extrapolate, predict, and so on from the numbers, that research that you've done here?
So I think there's some things numbers can tell you and some that we probably can't. Like one of the other things that we haven't quite touched on was the rise of other DOD. So your non-Army, Navy, Air Force, DOA was a big part of that, about half.
Logistics Agency.
Yeah, thank you. And to take the next step, a lot of that is going to be fuel. Some of that's just going to go away because having fuel in Afghanistan is incredibly expensive. But the other areas seem pretty robust. But there's other bigger questions that the Commission Wartime Contracting touched on. Like in Afghanistan, there's been at times a one-to-one ratio of service members to contractors. And as these wars run down, contractor deaths weren't really on the profile anywhere. In some ways, contracting can be almost a way of decreasing the political cost more than necessarily the financial cost of something. And as the war ends and as we deal with the people that were sometimes either lost family members or were directly harmed over there, do contractors have a new status, or is this going to be continuing? That's something they think is a strictly qualitative trend, but probably have a big quantitative implication, but is beyond my ability to predict.
We have about a minute left. I'd like to ask each one of you to give me just a thought or two about what you want somebody to take away from reading this work that you've done, which is terrific. Guy, I'll start with you.
I'd say that in order to understand sort of how the Department of Defense spends its money, you really need to look at individual services. You need to look at the differences between product services, research and development. It's not just a defense market. There are multiple defense markets. There are multiple defense customers. It's not just the Department of Defense as a one big entity. The devil is really in the details here, and we hope that this research can illuminate a lot of these details.
Greg, final thought?
There's room to move back to perhaps 2004 or 2001 levels if we're strategic about it. How to do it is beyond me, but there's room that we can say based on these numbers.
Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a terrific conversation. I've really enjoyed having both of you here.
Thanks very much.
The report is called U.S. Department of Defense Contract Spending and the Supporting Industrial Base, and you can find a link to it online at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll take you right to the CSIS website. Guy Ben-Ari and Greg Sanders of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, my guest, and this conversation will be archived on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Hour number 2 of In Depth with Francis Rose is next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.